Hello, everybody, and welcome back. It's the big one today. We have got Charles Atkins, Global Partnerships from Aptos, one of the people I've been following for the longest time around blockchain and enterprise. He's been doing some very big things. He's worked with some of the biggest companies in the world. And today we have got the pleasure of an hour with Charles talking about all things enterprise blockchain. Charles, how are you doing today, buddy?
Doing great. Yeah, thanks for having me on, Anthony.
So Charles, let's get into it. For those who don't know you, and that's probably a very small proportion of the LinkedIn Web3 audience at this point in time, but for those who don't know you, give us your brief background, please, and what have you been working on lately?
Yeah, the brief background is that originally started out in investment banking, so private equity for 6 years, and then with U.S. Department of Treasury, and then got into technology, blockchain, crypto, and NFTs for the second decade of my working career. And the running family joke that I went from wearing suits to selling cartoons, and that work, it sets better with some family members than it does with others. But yeah, I formerly was a VP at Polygon, and then also currently global partnerships here at Aptos. Really excited to be moving forward in the space and just seeing all the changes.
Very good. And so working for two of the biggest names, some of the most advanced or fast moving chains in Web3 at this point in time, those have had a number of significant partnerships, a number of big announcements lately as well. So you've been in the right places at the right time. I'm not going to talk about how you go from investment banking to the treasury. I've seen movies where people do those kind of deals. I'm not going to cast any aspersions on what may or may not have happened in your trading career.
But you're close. You're close.
We're just very happy to have you in Web3 right now. Let's get started with it. And I'd like the community to hear a little bit of your thesis around enterprise blockchain. Right, there's a number of challenges around the use of decentralized technology out there with organizations that are listed, that are commercial entities, that are capitalist. Decentralization doesn't always lend itself to the way a number of enterprises are wired today. Governments, you could argue the same thing, but from your experience so far, what's the case for enterprise blockchain, or why do you think it works when it works?
Yeah, I think as a lot of people listening probably know, especially if they're interested in both of us, that blockchain has been used by enterprises for quite a long time now. This isn't a new thing. It just so happens that they typically use a centralized blockchain, a Hyperledger Fabric, a R3, something like that, which is a permission chain. I like to give the example of Home Depot. Home Depot has been running their import-export on smart contracts for probably 6 or 7 years now. And it's not one of your basic decentralized chains. They run IBM on Microsoft Azure Cloud on IBM Hyperledger Fabrics. It's one of those things where I think now moving into the decentralized future, there's two things at play. Is a lot of these major enterprises don't like the idea of holding PII, personally identifying information, from users. The other thing that they're fighting against is the user data privacy laws. So it's getting to the point where they really don't have an option other than to make a lot of this data private. The other side of that is now consumers, regulators, several people are just requiring more transparency. And the easiest way that you allow this transparency for regulators, for consumers, is you do this on a permissionless chain that's open where people can read the ledger, search the ledger, make sure you're doing things above board. And I think those are the two things that enterprises are really focused on. And whether it be fortunate or unfortunate, they're getting forced into, which is great for people in the industry. And it's also great for consumers, I think.
Yeah, lots of cover and unpick there. I mean, also shout to Home Depot. That was one of the, I guess, the poster child use cases when I was still working at IBM a long time ago. And like you said, it doesn't necessarily have to be public blockchains all of the time. We're talking about the concept of using decentralized technology, right? Having a network of participants where you can allow data to flow and automation to happen. Right? You're instead of doing things sequentially, you're creating systems that are automated. There's business benefit in that. You don't have to put that all on a public chain. In fact, in a number of cases, you really shouldn't. And I'm glad you mentioned PII as well, because some of the things that I get to deal with in my day-to-day with Midnight is the challenges of people wanting to use public chains or people wanting to have that automation and have the infrastructure be public, but that metadata actually is published every time that you pay gas fees on a transaction, every time that you submit a transaction on certain chains, is there for everybody to see all of the time, right? Maybe the wallet name is obfuscated, maybe some of the transaction details are obfuscated, but there's still an opportunity to correlate a lot of that data. And that is a barrier, that's a hindrance for some people. And so the alternative for many is to go to private chains. And that's okay broadly, but it limits you to some extent in how much you can then open up development, open up the creation of a community and an ecosystem, build on top of that, if you have to be within the tent to be able to use, to be able to apply, and to be able to develop on top of what's being built. So I definitely hear you on that one. And then there's no predefined requirement for us to be using public chains, right? But there are significant benefits. I'm just seeing we've got guys, shout out to people who are coming in from Solana. Solana Breakpoint's happening right now. We've got people actually dialing in. The content at Solana Breakpoint is less interesting than what we're producing right now. So look at us right now. I'm very proud of that. So that's very good news. Let's talk a little bit about use cases, because again, it's always useful to illustrate some of the points. The Home Depot one's a very good one for me. And again, it's a use case where you can say, look, there was a business benefit behind that, and that's okay. What makes a great enterprise use case for you?
I think going back to what you just said, it's there's a sliding scale on what makes sense to put on chain and what doesn't. If Home Depot is running a smart contract that says if their lawnmowers are delivered a week late, that they pay 99% of that contract, who of us really care to see that? Like, we don't really care to see any, that makes no difference to us. But it is a way to automate that contract and make those payments a lot more seamless. Great use cases. We see a lot of brands out there where food and agriculture is one great use case where you're starting to see food tracing and sustainability of agriculture products is really a big deal, especially high-end luxury goods. We're seeing this with authentication. Great enterprise use case. There's enterprise use cases. I guess you can dial it down to any area in the world where there's commerce, even if it's connected to IoT devices. There's things out there where water purification is tested through an IoT device. Those results are written to blockchain every 15 minutes. Great use case, because if there's ever contamination in the water, you don't just have to go rely on a guy with a clipboard who said he's been testing the water every day. Maybe he hasn't, or maybe he's been paid not to. And now we can get into those situations with global users, global governments, where these things are really put into a trustless environment. So you're not relying on humans to give you all of the information you need. It's there, it's automated. We know it can be trusted for the most part. And we rely on that information.
The IoT use cases are very strong for me, although they are challenging, right? Anytime where you have to have a physical sensor or validation of something physical happening in the world, you do have a challenge with the assurance, but people point to carbon credits and carbon certification, certainly testing in industrial settings that certain equipment was calibrated or that it was operating within certain performance characteristics that it is licensed to do, and as a result is within insurance parameters or is within operating parameters for warranty and so on and so forth. Right? People, there's a whole swathe of B2B use cases that are so nebulous and so detailed and so deep, but where the cost of equipment or the cost of capital is or capital machinery is so significant that it's that there's huge amounts, millions and billions of dollars worth of insurance costs or warranty costs or stock that are at risk. These things, a lot of people don't pay notice to. And so certification, definitely transparency and certification, clear use cases. Have you been spending much time thinking about some of the ones that are emerging now around cookieless e-commerce or looking at loyalty, bring your own credentials? We'll talk about credentials and education and certification later, but it seems like loyalty is getting a lot of interest right now.
Yeah, that's one of the areas, and especially I think a lot of this has been brought on by, we can see what happened when the Apple iOS App Store dropped a lot of the tracking use cases. Marketers have had to spend significantly more to get installs to track people. It's been pretty difficult. Now, it's pretty well known that the end of 2024, Google and the Chrome ecosystem is going to start deprecating third-party cookies, which, by the way, they're only about 30 to 40% accurate even today anyway. But that does mean that from what I've been hearing from a report I've read from Gartner, they say basically in the year 2025, a CMO or a marketer has to add 40% to their ad spend in order to get the same results as today when you start taking away third-party cookies. So loyalty has become a big deal just because of that one-to-one communication with your user, with your customer. Obviously, you need to provide them value in order to get that data exchange. The other thing by doing it on chain and why loyalty is so important is, we've talked about this before, is like ZK proofs and utilizing things like that, where it's, you don't need a whole idea of who this person, you don't need all of their personally identifying information to know how to do marketing towards them. If I'm a company like Anheuser-Busch, this is an example I use with people all the time. Let's say in the United States, you have to be 21 years old to drink alcohol. You go to a local bar, local club, you hand a bouncer your ID outside the door. He's now seen your license number, your name, your address, your age. He's seen five different pieces of information about you just as you're walking in. And when you start shielding a lot of that information, the only thing they really needed to know was, are you 21? Yes or no. But now you've opened up all of your other information to people with things like, I know the stuff that you're working on, with things that we're working on, you only really have to allow that one piece of information that's needed in order to conduct or move forward in that transaction. And I think that's why you see a lot of that in loyalty, because they only need to know if you bought five coffees this month. They don't need your email address. They don't need your home address. They don't need to know that you've bought a pair of shoes at the mall last week. They don't need that stuff. And so for a lot of loyalty companies and large brands, they're actually seeing that holding on to this PII, this personally identifying information, is a huge cybersecurity risk moving into the future, especially with AI, especially with quantum. When you start talking about 5 years from now, where a typewritten password is basically useless, you really start having concerns about what information you're holding and what you're not holding.
And there's some of your business cases right there. I'm going to play some of those back, right? The 40% increase in ad spend. Anywhere where you can reduce that requirement to, you know, where you can have somebody bring their own credentials and reduce the need to have to spend more to target them, that same spend can be used or traded off in rewards. That's a good thing. The data governance story, right? It costs something in the order of magnitude of about $4 to $5 million every time an organization gets hacked, in terms of lost revenue, in terms of reputation, in terms of maybe having to have auditors come in, maybe in terms of sanctions or fines as a result of it. Could be lots of different things, but $5 million every time that you get hacked, every time that honeypot of data that you have that's connected to the internet becomes an attack vector for others, that's bad news. And so for corporate governance and data governance alone, there's a business case. Lots of different ways that you can cut it. And thank you for the segue into kind of the work that we're doing with Midnight and Zero Knowledge Proofs. Anywhere that you pass actual data is an opportunity where you can send a proof instead of the real data. Right? We've been conditioned, or it's become normalized, that we share photocopies of our driver's license or photocopies of our passports. I don't know how many times in the course of the internet you've done that. I've probably done it 50, maybe 100 times as proofs of my address, or as proofs that I'm a citizen, or proofs of this, that, or the other. Okay, maybe I'm not sending it over email, but sometimes I'm literally putting it up to my computer screen, similar to this. Still sending identifiable information. Still have a significant data governance challenge. And the building on top of that, with what you mentioned earlier about devices, machines, identity, IoT, the amount of data and potentially sensitive data that organizations are capturing as their systems get more smart, or as their workflows or as their applications become more connected, you are proliferating exponentially the amount of data governance that's required. And that cannot be sustainable for most enterprises. So finding a different way of using proofs is a good thing. But then also, if you've got centralized proofs, or you've got proofs that are created by the own entity, you're still governing your own proofs, which you've just moved the problem to somewhere else in your organization and keeping it centralized. And so you still have the governance challenge. Whereas if you can work with open source decentralized technology, you can validate that the proofs are authentic. You can validate that they're governed by third parties, so it's not your responsibility to manage. And you can use that system based on the IT function's evaluation of the proofs and the authentication within this particular blockchain, whether it's Midnight or not, is sufficient for us to manage our risk or to govern our data effectively. Literally any app where you're sending personal data, you can replace with a proof. And I think that's the reason I'm doing the job right now. But I think that's probably underestimated as a transformation lever for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think that's something that, you know, and unfortunately, I think it's going to take a couple of major negative occurrences to happen before people really start to realize that. It's always more difficult to get people to do something preemptively than it is to have something terrible happen and then you think about it later. people always buy the most life insurance after a close family member has died. And that's a really unfortunate thing. And that's the situation we're in now. And that's why at Aptos, same thing. We have so many decentralized validators all over the world. And the reason we do that is because when you have this data that needs to be verified through several validators, large companies running very robust hardware, you don't have that single failure point. All of those validators need to come together, agree to a consensus on a transaction, whether they should send that proof, verify that proof, yes or no. And in order to hack all of those validator nodes at once, have something like that happen, it's I hate to use the word impossible, but it's pretty impossible today.
It's going to be very expensive for sure. Even just the amount of phishing that you might have to do a human style attack, if not a technology style attack, it is probably the maths don't balance out in terms of the cost to make the attack versus the reward. I want to touch briefly on NFTs, because I know that's something that you've spoken frequently about, it's something you followed. And I also think it's one of the most misunderstood terms and domains within Web3, the decentralized internet, right? People look at NFTs and they think that's about art. That's about issuing digital stamps, issuing digital collectibles that companies can make money from. Adidas did very well. I don't know, was it in just several tens of millions that they made from digital fashion collectibles? Various different avatar platforms. One of the earliest NFT use cases, Lamborghini did postage stamps digitally. And fun exploration of the technology, but probably not game changing for them in terms of product portfolio. I want to get your take on this because I'll share my thoughts afterwards. But I think people are misreading the opportunity around the tokenization of things. And I want to see what's your spiel. When you talk about NFTs, what do you share that helps people get that it's more than just pictures of monkeys?
Yeah, really to move them off of the idea of the pictures of monkey topic, I like to tell people that just imagine an NFT is a large 18-wheeler truck. That can just be a vessel that's driving on a highway. Highway's the blockchain. But what's inside that truck? Yeah, that could be a picture of a monkey. That could also be a bill of lading from an oil delivery from one country to another. That could be 1/48th of a piece of commercial real estate that's been tokenized and issued as an NFT. Whatever the payload is within that NFT, it's basically anything that's been tokenized. It doesn't even have to be an image at all. So the second part of that is really non-fungible token just essentially means that it doesn't have an equivalent dollar value that's the same as something else. So it can literally be anything. And like you pointed to, you can tokenize so many things that a lot of people are not even thinking about. And the reason I think it makes it really easy is Kier Finlow-Bates, who I know a lot of people follow on LinkedIn.
Shout out Blockchain Gandalf.
Blockchain Gandalf. One of the best books that he put out, one of the first books on blockchain that I actually bought and read all the way through. Actually, I think I have it right here. Oh, it's on the ground. But basically,
Go get it. We should give him the due credit and the shout out. If it's accessible to you, go grip it up because I think Kier needs all the love he can get. The Authorverse has been relatively doomed.
I'm gonna grab it real quick. It's right here on the side.
We'll play some Lyft music in the background while, for those of you who are listening in on podcasts,
I don't keep it that far away.
Oh, it's always close to hand.
Yeah, so I like the title of this because this is exactly why move over brokers, here comes blockchain. And that's one of the things that when you start tokenizing these assets and you start tokenizing different pieces of the physical world, let's use real estate, for example. If I own 1/48th of a hotel building and today I'm in an LLC that owns this, I have to sell my share. I have to have that share go through all kinds of legal paperwork. Why can't I just list that on an exchange? It's an NFT, but just buy my share of this hotel directly on chain. Now you own it. That's it. It's moving a lot of these brokers, which are really just extracting value, out of the way.
Really good point. And this is exactly where I was hoping you would go with the explanation. I definitely wasn't expecting the shill for Kier Finlow-Bates' book, but I'm delighted to see it. I'll allow it. I'll encourage it. We're always here, friend of the show. But the point here is you're creating infrastructure that allows the minting, discovery, trading of assets to become faster, easier, global, 24/7. Why do that? Because you can change the units of acquisition. You can fractionalize that piece of real estate or that particular vehicle or that particular bill of lading to the point where you can sell it for cents as opposed to an individual item. That attracts more liquidity. That attracts people who are able to invest in smaller ticket amounts. That allows people to transact and allow the market itself to become more liquid, because people don't have to buy a $500,000 house in one go. They can buy a small amount of an investment property at a time. You can create markets around that. You can create finance around that. You can leverage those assets. If they're tokenized and there's a marketplace which recognizes it, you can leverage it. So you can create finance against that. It becomes more transparent in terms of how it's being moved. The data around markets become more transparent if you can see how well assets are moving and how quickly. Right. As of today, we can see that there's $40 billion worth of crypto being traded every day, because we can go and use on-chain analysis or go to CoinDesk or CoinMarketCap or wherever you prefer to go. And that data is visible today, right? Instantly, in real time. How do we know how much stocks and shares were traded today? It's not hard to follow, but it's probably less easy to follow, right? That data is available, open and transparent for everybody. That's just the first list of things that are probably generic around business and technology benefits of tokenization or creating marketplaces that are global and open. If you get into industries at a time, the ability to, again, add more liquidity to certain use cases. I know one of the famous IBM use cases from back in the day with Norilsk Nickel was the ability to have retail investors or smaller ticket investors invest behind nickel as a commodity. Or palladium, sorry, not nickel. Invest behind palladium as a commodity. I've never invested in palladium in my life, but if I want to have maybe a different commodity in my portfolio, I don't have to go to some out-of-date brokerage or have to buy a kilo of the damn stuff. I can just buy $20 worth of it, and maybe other people will too. Lots and lots of reasons why it's not about creating NFTs as items, right? This is not art. This is about managing the ownership rights, trading and liquidity around literally anything. And BCG say that there's something like $16, $17 trillion worth of assets in the world that could be made more liquid, or that could be better leveraged or better enabled through tokenization as opposed to the out-of-date, inefficient systems that we use today. And I think that's pretty powerful. We're halfway through, and I would be remiss if I didn't get to ask you about what you're actually working on today, which is Aptos. You've been there working on global partnerships, probably one of the most glamorous jobs in the business. For those people who don't know Aptos or what you've been up to, tell us what that means.
Yeah, for those of you that don't know Aptos, we were originally founded inside. Aptos wasn't founded inside, but based on the same principles and a lot of the same individuals that helped create the Diem chain, the Libra coin, and the Novi wallet inside of Facebook. And so then Congress wasn't entirely happy with that project. And so that we spun Aptos out, luckily full approval to do that. So Aptos is basically built within that. It's a layer one blockchain that was essentially built to manage billions of people. If you can imagine all of the products that are inside of Meta, Instagram, WhatsApp, this was built with the idea that billions of people would eventually be using this chain. And so now with global partnerships, obviously we're working on those use cases that have incredible scale. We have really high scalability, high throughput, high TPS, very fast finality through several of our validator nodes. I think Masari just ranked us at 0.9 seconds finality, and pretty fast. And that's important when it comes to security, when it comes to financial markets, payment rails, things that need to be transacted quickly, in-game assets. If you're picking up a weapon, you don't want to wait 30 minutes for it to show up in your wallet. Just really making the accessibility of blockchain as simple as it is in the traditional world without really getting people deep diving into all of the technical aspects of it.
Got you. And obviously at this point in time, we've been through, you and I both have been through probably 8 or 9 years or probably more's worth of trying to overcome barriers and concerns of enterprises, adoption of blockchain technology. We don't have the developers. We don't want all of our data to be on chain. We don't understand the scripting language. Chain is coin, Bitcoin's for criminals. The list continues, right? But when you're going into some of those conversations, what are some of the modern upgrades or things that you talk about that make it easier or that make those barriers lower to enterprises that you're looking to partner with today?
Yeah, I think the natural progression of where things are going with data, with privacy, with the ability to decentralize that risk, that actually is a topic for a lot of companies out there. Those enterprise talks are a lot easier when you're talking about the traditional finance sector, it's the things that you brought up. It's the main factor there is liquidity. They can tokenize more of what they're doing and get additional liquidity from smaller fractionalized amounts. Why wouldn't they do that? They basically turn their financial organization into a living, breathing mechanism. Instead of trading several million shares a day, now they may be trading billions, trillions of transactions. It almost turns that financial organization into a 24-hour like moving organism of finance. And that's the thing. The major concerns are people are still thinking with a lot of that old school thought of, I'm going to have a user come on. They have to stop. They have to create a wallet. It's going to take them 12 minutes. They have to transfer crypto. Oh, they haven't done their KYC AML to actually have a crypto wallet. They have to do that. Write down their 12, 24-word seed phrase. Come back, transact. Modern blockchain is not like that anymore. We have abstracted most of that until the point where you really want to actually transact outward. You won't even know that you're doing things on blockchain. There are single sign-ons. You can have account abstraction where you're just creating accounts in parallel as a user's creating account. If you're in a game, email, login, everything's basically running in the background until the point where you may look at your account and say, hey, wow, I've got $200 worth of weapons in this game. What could I do with it? At that point, yes, you're going to be willing to go through the friction because now you have some value added to your account. You'll go through the friction of getting that put into an internal marketplace, buy, sell, trade those assets. But getting people onboarded, all of that friction needs to be taken away. And it's not like it was 4 or 5 years ago. It's a very different world in blockchain now.
Yeah, I like to hear that. And I think what you're talking about there is the difference between custodial and non-custodial wallets or wallets hosted by the application or by a third party in the cloud that's consumed by the application. So again, you're logging in to identify yourself using existing kind of OAuth type of services from the Googles, the Facebooks, the whoever's who are providing login services. But like at some point when there's value at stake, you're going to need to create that seed phrase. You're going to need to store some passwords for yourself. Maybe use a third-party password manager. Maybe you have a ledger or some sort of hardware device that you could plug in that we can make that process easier for you as an individual. But don't make the first point of contact a 14-step process with a KYC, with having to choose your favorite crypto wallet of choice to be able to upload or download $100 worth of crypto to your wallet to then have your first 2-cent transaction to enter the game. Remember, I can't remember which wallet it was. I think it was MoonPay back in the day. I looked at the number of screens and I think it was about 7 to 8 different screens and a separate KYC check from my bank just for that part of the process. And that was after I'd done the initial onboarding in the app to then go through this to then have to come back. And this is probably 2 years ago, right? So it's nice to know that things have moved along. And it's also nice that I've heard at least 3 references to gaming today. Are you bullish on Web3 gaming? Do you think this is because the assets are digital, because the games are at the moment largely siloed and there's opportunities to interweave worlds and items and assets? Do you see gaming as a bastion for Web3 and decentralized tech, or are you still a little skeptical?
I do think gaming's going to get there, but I think people should be thinking about this with a little bit of historical lens. So I think if people remember when mobile gaming first took off, what you saw in successful mobile games is you didn't see existing PC games or existing console games just being converted over to mobile and having any success. It was, you had to have brand new game mechanics, brand new type of screens, much lower load when it came to like speed, usability. And that's when you see things like Angry Birds and stuff like that, really farm simulators, things that are just really easy to follow, catch on. And I'm curious now, and this is something that I am bullish on gaming. I haven't seen a lot of success with, again, we're not seeing PC console games directly convert perfectly into a Web3 game. And this is something I'm still debating and doing research on, is I'm wondering if creating an entirely new type of gaming that's more suited towards Web3 with mechanics that are more suited towards the ecosystem is the smart way to go, the same way that mobile developers did, because now there's added mechanics in there that you could never do before and is not an exact one-to-one parody of existing PC games. I know gaming is the place to be only because that's where commerce is taking place. That's where people enact a lot of their social activities now. You'd be shocked just the amount of people that play in games and the economies that are happening in Fortnite and Roblox. It's these are economies of scale, and they have major and massive network effects. And it'd be crazy to not give it a shot. We're extremely bullish on gaming. We just want to make sure that games are doing the right things that work for having them built on blockchain.
100%. And while I pull up a comment from Jacek, which I think is probably comment of the day, Jacek, you win on this one. For those of you listening on the podcast as opposed to watching in live, there's been a very generous comment as to the quality of Charles's mustache. So for those who are listening, and I can't describe it perfectly, so I'm not going to try, but you're going to have to jump back to the LinkedIn to watch it live. It's a thing of beauty. That aside, particularly related to gaming, I think the innovation there may not necessarily have to come all the way in the gameplay, because I think you have the idea of digital items, you have the idea of in-game economies, of farming, of trading between parties, right? That's been there since games existed. I think to me, there's a couple of areas. It's probably the non-gameplay or the non-active gameplay part of it, which is marketplaces. I think being able to create marketplaces where there's enough content, where there's enough value, where the user experience is sufficient. A lot of the Web3 games that I've seen are coming out with gated NFTs and closed marketplaces, which is about as useful as having a non-Web3 game. There's absolutely zero point in having NFTs in your game if the marketplace is closed and you can't trade it outside. But in that comes the risk, is if you open it up, that opens it up to global economics. And it's not easy to predict the impact on your tokens, your items, if things become fully open all of the time, right? So there's some risk there, but that's something people are going to have to F around and find out. I think the second part of it is the interoperability, and not cross-chain interoperability per se, is more a case of being able to have games that will allow items from other games to come across. I think there's huge potential in driving, as a loyalty mechanic, users to certain games by offering them digital collectibles that are accessible across, or skins or whatever else it might be, to give them a boost in a certain game. Now, what you don't want to do is ruin your own game's progression by bringing in characters that are completely overpowered within the first round because they've got a whole bunch of other items and you brought in a whale from some other gaming universe and suddenly that person's crushing everybody because they've just bought their way to the top. In the same way, I guess in Roblox, there is a pay-to-win concept there. You do have YouTubers who can come in, drop $5,000 on some crazy items, just go around Shrekking everybody. It happens, and that's fine. But for the long-term success of a game, I think you need to make that more balanced and more accessible to that kind of, maybe not the sort of bottom of the pyramid, but the middle of the pyramid that pays the money or that creates the value for you for that game, to be able to allow attracting those people in. And the challenge is game studios don't really think that way for the most part, right? They're siloed particular content streams. There's individual games that behave in a certain way that maybe they have series or they grow over time, but they don't cross, right? Madden doesn't cross into FIFA, although maybe it's starting to get there. You started to see a few players Messi starting to appear in Madden, for example, or something daft like that. Or you start seeing certain items from certain different versions of the game appear in others, which skins and guns is an easy thing to cross over. But I think the game developers and the people who are funding game development are the ones, that's where the innovation needs to be driven by. It's not that consumers can't envisage it. It's that you need to have created the game economy mechanics and the loyalty mechanics and have priced that in to figure out, is it worth me using a blockchain, spending an extra X million dollars on these features because it will return me X number of players, X million dollars in marketplace fees or in the value of my items, tokens, etc. But there's no doubt, I think it was Dr. Doom? I can't remember, a famous game streamer, Dr. Disrespect came out saying, imagine the world where you're watching a live Dota stream or something like that, and you're seeing people trying to extract with a digital item that they know for a fact is worth $100,000 in the real world. And the amount of excitement that will create. And then what happens when that item appears somewhere else, or you can highlight or market the fact that these items are going to be available, that these loot crates are worth this much in, could just be regular crypto, right? It could be stablecoin. Could be a crate that's openable with stable coins that you need to get a certain number of keys for. The questing element to this is already established in gaming. It's just that we haven't done it with real money. I guess the final thing also then is, how do we enable these guys to be tax compliant? at the same time, because once you start dropping hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions of dollars of crypto around the gaming ecosystem, you're going to suddenly have 14-year-olds who've got a whole bunch of stable coins that maybe the IRS wants to know about. I don't even want to go there.
Yeah, no, I love the idea of just enabling, like you said, loot. That's a great idea, actually. A great game mechanic is like multi-sig loot boxes. That would be really fun to like team up with people and make sure that you could go unlock those together. I think the other thing that's really difficult, and I definitely am not, I'm not envious of the game designers that have to figure out the economics, but you're essentially, you've got the outside, the in real world, the in real life economies of all of our individual countries. And then you start layering in, what are the economics within a game? You're basically building economics inside of another system of economics. Like you said, when you have a whale come in and buy up every asset that's there and just start totally just killing everybody in there, that's a very difficult thing because it's very hard to predict in-game economics when you don't know the economics of the users that are always playing in there. I do not envy the job of tokenomics for Web3 games. That is one of the hardest balancing acts to play out there. So I know there's people that say, I want to study the tokenomics of this game and I'll know if it's a good game or not. No, you won't. You really won't. Because predicting the economics of a game is nearly impossible.
Yeah, just understanding what is the successful path for certain items in a game, the game economics or the progression, I think can probably be tracked because it has been modeled. But the number of factors at play when you make that an open economy, when you make that based on anybody's money anywhere in the world, I'm with you. I think the prediction or the ability to predict that becomes very hard. Yes, you can probably assess supply versus demand. You can probably assess, is a token deflationary or not? And so are things going to get scarce or rarer? But then after a while, a team could just drop, okay, well, now it's season 2. Everything that happened in season 2.
And the speed of which it happens, because like you said, with it only takes one streamer that's extremely popular to go in and start playing the game or talking about the game. And all of a sudden, your economy has got such higher velocity than you anticipated because of the number of users. It makes things really difficult. It makes things difficult to set that up in a non-flexible way.
I think so. And this is the massive opportunity for people is economists or economy modelers who probably maybe bored about doing some macroeconomics for governments, come over into video gaming and Web3. There's still all of the same math that you're familiar with, but with some really interesting new challenges. So come in and have a go at that. I also, in that previous segment, want to give another shout out to Keir, multi-sig loot crates in the Orthoverse. If you're listening in, Keir, please make it happen. Of anybody who could make it happen, I'm sure he's the one. So next time there's a 20 Doge loot crate challenge in the Orthoverse, this is where it started, right? I can't remember what Keir's favorite. He gives away a lot of ETH. I think he's lost faith in ETH. I think he was donated some ETH by a subscriber at some point in time, and he's been using it as rewards for people ever since. He created his own
debt token, which I thought was hilarious, and gave it to everybody in the world.
I still have mine.
Yeah, I have mine. 100 debts. And I was like, man, you couldn't have named that any better.
Exactly. The biggest airdrop of all time. I don't know. Some people are trying to do bigger. I'm not saying anything here because I'm not licensed to, but there are some people. That was just every Ethereum address that exists or that could ever exist. I think that was Keir's airdrop. We might beat that one day, Keir. You watch this space. On to the next segment, and we are getting some questions coming in, so appreciate everybody else who's been putting the questions in the chat. We are going to try and get through as many of them as we can at the end. If you've got any more, please do jump into the chat now. If you have any more comments about Charles's facial hair, those are welcome too. My facial hair, it's a bit of a messy, scruffy beard, to be honest, but there we go. Let's talk about driving further adoption. We've seen that it's getting easier for users to engage with blockchain. To some extent, we're seeing that it's easier for enterprises to consume APIs, blockchain backends from enterprise SaaS type of players. We're starting to see less use of esoteric languages and more use of Python, JavaScript, TypeScript, etc. What do you think are some of the other unlocks or some of the other barriers that we need to overcome to start seeing more enterprise adoption of blockchain and decentralized apps?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest ones that, especially in a market like we're facing today and maybe facing in the near future, is understanding how a lot of enterprise budgeting works. And they really start diving into the idea of, show me what the value is here. and you have to really show them what the future looks like. You're trying to sell an organization and an enterprise on what their next 3 to 5 year roadmap is, and they're having to report earnings for next quarter. And so it really takes enterprises with really forward thinking individuals that work there, that have a longer time horizon, that are willing to put in the work to actually get these implemented. But I will tell you, if they start today, start getting that implementation done, they won't have to worry about a lot of the risks that we had talked about earlier in the show into the future. Unfortunately, it's what we had said before is a lot of times something bad's going to happen before they adopt it. But I do think if you show them the true value and the reasons that they shouldn't be holding on to a ton of PII, or a reason that you can get more robust user data in an anonymous way that they're going to be able to activate on, especially through loyalty and marketing systems. It's a really big deal. People spend billions of dollars on marketing every year. And to know that they can do that in a more robust way, a way that's more based on behavior than it is just having somebody's email address and phone number, I think they're open to it, especially with data privacy laws coming into place. Their budgets are going to get completely wrecked. They should start thinking about these things, and just giving them the understanding that these things are not as hard to implement today as they were 5 or 10 years ago. It's much, much easier now. Like you said, through APIs, a lot of the coding languages are becoming simple and well-known. We're just moving in the right direction. We've passed the dial-up era of blockchain, and we're moving into the high-speed internet stage. We're getting there.
That's a good point. And I think the business case part of it is still probably underrepresented, or probably under-marketed for sure, because a lot of projects have been through proofs of concept. If Home Depot is still running blockchain, albeit private infrastructure, and they're still paying the implementation and integration costs for companies like IBM to continue to develop, you've got to believe that particular part of their world, or that particular financial transformation, is going to be worth tens of millions of dollars because of the cost just alone to make that happen. Also, shout out to Dial-Up Internet, for those who remember, one of the best dinner party challenges in the world after people have had a couple of glasses of wine. Who can most appropriately replay the exact sound that a dial-up modem used to make when you were trying to connect to the internet? Try that one next time you've got a few people around the house. It's obviously, cover your ears a little bit. It does get a bit noisy, but that's how I choose my friends. Anybody who cannot replicate the sound of a dial-up modem cannot be my friend, or at least does not get to come to the next dinner party. True story. So talk about business case. We talk about the technology as well. So we're clearly seeing accessibility. We're also seeing custodial wallets. We're starting to see APIs as part of the story as well, which I think is good. I think one of the big parts of what more do we need to see adoption and scale is not, we don't need more block space. We don't need more blockchains. We don't need more sharding. We don't need more token standards. We do need more middleware. And I don't think, when asked, the Web3 community has answered this one particularly well, in saying, what more do we need? Actually, it's the bridge between layer ones, underlying infrastructure, and making it easy to connect blockchain backends to applications that companies want to use. Enterprises consume software. They don't really consume infrastructure. I don't think you see that many people hard coding their own infrastructure these days. A lot of it is the SaaSification of apps, or the SaaSification of corporate processes. And so a big part of what I'd like to see more is blockchains partnering with enterprise SaaS organizations and actually trying to provide, obviously, all of the functionality and features, but have that be obfuscated by a company that knows how to do UX for B2B. I think that's a major key, because blockchain layer one people, they're mathematicians, they're cryptographers, they're core engineers, they're incredibly smart people, but they're not used to doing enterprise integrations, or they're not used to spending a lot of time selling SaaS. And so that's something that I think I'd like to see more of. Do you have dream partnerships or dream integrations for Aptos, or for the teams that you work with? Are there some of the ones that you wish you see more of?
I think exactly like you said, we're building something for loyalty systems called Aptos Integrator, and it's exactly what you described. It's basically, we figured out the key functionality of most major loyalty platforms, whether they be custom built or platform SaaS offerings, build a set of APIs that basically do all of that functionality, but also integrate new functionality like socialized loyalty and groupings and challenges and all of that fun stuff. And we basically build the API set down to the infrastructure. And then everything from API set up to front end build is the responsibility of the loyalty platform. And that's, we're seeing more of that happen. And it's just something that's needed. We have gaming SDKs that are out there. So these SDKs and APIs and just making it very easy for the people that want to plug into the blockchain, do it through the same type of things that they're already used to using. And we'll handle the back end. You guys, everyone out there building for big brands, you guys use your Accentures to build your front end and the Hangs of the world to build your loyalty platforms. Like, that's great. We just plug right into them through APIs. I think dream partnerships, I think what you said earlier in the beginning, like, we love working with large traditional financial institutions and tokenizing real world assets. It's a big deal. Providing more liquidity with more speed into those marketplaces can make a really big difference. That's a big deal. I think obviously in the gaming space, getting more of the large game developers understanding the blockchain use cases and having them maybe get a little bit more buy-in. Again, most of the large gaming companies are now publicly traded. So they do have that whole making sure they have that quarter to quarter kind of sentiment for their investors and stakeholders, which is a little tough to overcome. They still, the stakeholders and shareholders still view blockchain as a high risk maneuver in gaming. So they have to do it a little bit more quietly than they would probably want to. Yeah. Any of those where we start seeing people, large amounts of people take control of their own data, give permission to brands to use it or not, and then also provide higher liquidity, safety, and privacy to major enterprises. I think that's the ultimate solve for everybody. I think all of us in this industry are working towards that, though.
I like that. I think that there's education still to do. There are integrations still to do. But if we're expecting in 2023 that large enterprises are still going to build native dApps or going to roll their own smart contracts, I think we're mistaken. Any more than you actually see enterprise IT teams building their own internal enterprise apps. They use Workable, they use Monday.com, they use Slack, they use whatever it is, Salesforce, SAP. This is an established paradigm. Let's get with it if we want to try and get some enterprise adoption. And final question before we get into the Q&A, any final words of advice for enterprises out there who are looking to build with blockchain? Any kind of final thoughts of things we didn't cover?
Yeah, two things we touched on early on is enterprise blockchain, and blockchain in particular is not necessarily crypto, cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, all the stuff that you see on the news. There's many different use cases. And the fact that tokenization doesn't mean a picture of a monkey. Just take the 15 minutes to call one of us and just let us explain the fact that blockchain and the use of enterprise blockchain is not a bunch of meme coins and donkeys riding a spaceship to the moon. Pictures. So
it's also that, but it's not just that.
It is, and, also, you know, that it's not just that.
Let's enjoy the memes while we have them, and let's enjoy the creativity of new areas of digital culture that are being explored. I think we would be remiss if we didn't enjoy that. But enterprises don't always have that sense of humor, and they're not always going to be there for exactly that content. We do have some questions, so let's try and do some of these. We've got 5 minutes, so we'll try and see which one are we going to start with first. Here's one from Tanish. Which incentives do organizations have to adopt this technology? So what's the business case, right? We've seen people used to exposing their PII to the platforms they use. What are some of the incentives that you see commonly?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes in the fact of they're not going to want to hold that PII any longer. They're starting to see... Loyalty is a good example of that. There's been major hacks into loyalty systems. Dunkin' Donuts, I think, had 350 million pieces of data stolen. Caesars Casino recently had a hack that was involved with their loyalty platform. And I think a lot of us as just general consumers, we have exposed our PII far too easily into far too many organizations. And the fact is, we don't even know how much of our data is out there because we've shared it so freely over time. I think for organizations, what typically ends up happening is if there is a major data breach that ends up in financial impact for a lot of their users, they end up going through lawsuits, they end up going through settlements. It costs them much more in reputation and actual financial hit than it would to just implement this technology early on. And again, like, these hacks are not getting lesser as technology improves. They're increasing in size, velocity, and complexity.
100%. And the technology that is enabling these hacks to happen is only going to get smarter and better at the same time. So just imagine how phishing schemes are going to work now we have AI and a credible voice replication as well. That's just going to mess with a lot. Batsarai is also mentioning in here, isn't that what ZK chains are for? I wanted to probably just pick on this one briefly because I think you use different promises around zero knowledge at this point in time, depending on who you talk to. And I think there's an important difference between privacy chains, data protection, and rollups. So there's a bunch of organizations, a bunch of layer twos around Ethereum that are using zero knowledge technology for scalability. And that's okay. That's a good thing. When you're a chain like Ethereum, scalability is important. So when you see ZK in some instances, zero knowledge, they're using that to bundle or to group transactions, reduce cost, and anchor those and settle them on the main chain. That's zero knowledge for rollups and scalability. You then see the use of zero knowledge for privacy chains. And in some cases, that everything on the chain, as opposed to everything on Ethereum being public all of the time, everything on a privacy chain is private all of the time. But in this space, you get into some of the challenges that Tornado Cash and others have got into, which is if everything's private all the time and no one can see what's going on, regulators don't love that oftentimes, depending on which applications are being built on that chain. So from a compliance perspective, you've got a challenge with ZK there. This is where the next generation of ZK chains, those shall remain nameless, but I work for one, are looking at a mix of some public, some private, and having that running simultaneously through as a smart contract chain. So we are using selective privacy and selective publicity or transparency. That's where I think the direction of travel needs to be for blockchain, because the transparency is good, but we don't need it all the time. The privacy is good, but we can't have it universally because of compliance. A very brief shout to ZK. Also, a point from Joris here, which games companies are trying to set up those closed marketplaces. Now, I don't want to call out names here specifically. I don't want to point towards any of them, but this was, at least for me, and I don't know if you observed the same thing, the early Web3 games were, we're going to issue you NFTs. Maybe you can hold them in your wallet, but you can only ever sell them through our marketplace, because our marketplace, that's where we generate the fees and that's how we make the money as a game. And so the economic model for the game to make profit was centered around them having their own marketplace. And that's part of the challenge. So Joris, shout to you for that one. And then we've probably got time for one more. Which one are we going with? Oh, this is a good one. I like this one. So shout out to Siva. What are your thoughts on too many blockchain protocols? So do we have too many blockchains? Do we see consolidation? I'm going to let you have a first crack at this one, Charles, because I have my thesis. But do you think we have too many blockchains? Do you think we're going to see some ramping down over time?
Consolidation of decentralized chains would be very tough. These are mostly permissionless, foundation-run, community-run chains that are open source, that already have information written to the chain. Back consolidating all of that information accurately, I'm not smart enough to figure out how to do that. I think that would be a real challenge. It's not as easy as when I was first getting into technology. The big question that was very similar to this is, do we have too many browsers? Because everybody had a browser and everybody had a search engine. And it's like, do we have too many of them? And eventually what happened was, guess what? The best product won. And that didn't mean that all of the history of searches and history of everything happening on those other browsers and things that were hosted within those other companies migrated over. It just meant that new things were built on the winner. And that's what, I'm not going to say it's going to be one or five chains or however it may be, but there are going to be, in my opinion, some best use cases and some challengers and some that are clear market standouts.
That's a nice way of framing. I think if you look at cloud as another analogy for this, there is not just one cloud provider for everybody in the world. If you think of cloud as infrastructure where data gets stored, where compute and automation can happen, where loads can be balanced for applications and servers and the way that enterprises and games run today, a lot of that is managed on cloud infrastructure. You've got at least five, probably seven global of scale, very significant technology companies running some of the major cloud platforms in the world. And they do that because they offer cloud, but they offer other services as well. There are regional variations. There are language variations. If you look at some particular blockchains, you'll see some of the ecosystem they have is centered around certain geographies because a lot of their documentation and developers are based in certain locations. a lot of their business development happens in regions where their people are based. And that's probably still going to be the case until you've run out of enterprises to adopt, until you've run out of use cases. If block space is ubiquitous and there's no significant difference in using a smart contract, deploying a dApp, and having data exist on a blockchain in perpetuity, you're going to have people choosing what they want, where they want. I think maybe taking the browser example forward, if I started trying to run AltaVista now, 1998 version, or even before, I don't know what's 1994 version, 1996 version of AltaVista, it would not be compatible today because there are upgrades to the code, upgrades to the way that certain internet standards and communication standards have been advanced. That means that that version of the browser just cannot work anymore, or it cannot integrate. It may still work under certain conditions, but it cannot integrate. And so the ability for blockchains and the software and that their ecosystems are building, wallets, marketplaces, around how we compile blockchain technology into the way that we consume web and applications today, I think that coalescence is going to be important too. And on that note, we are at the hour. Charles, it's been great having you on the show. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. It's taken us a long time to get this to happen, but I'm very grateful to have you here. Great to hear about the work you're doing at Aptos. Great to get a little bit of an insider view as to why Aptos is different and what you've been working on that's particularly unique, to have spun out of Facebook, to go on to become a layer one chain, and to go on to have kind of the notoriety that Aptos has received is significant. And so shout to you for being a part of that story. Thank you everybody for watching. Thank you everybody for listening in. Thank you for all the questions and the comments. Sorry we didn't get through all of them, but maybe we'll try and get through some of the extra ones in the chat afterwards. Have a brilliant rest of your day, Charles, and stay safe out there, buddy.
Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to the Blockchain Won't Save the World podcast. As always, opinions in this episode are mine and those of my guests alone. If you want to find out more, please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. Check out some of the other episodes on the Blockchain Won't Save the World podcast and check out the YouTube channel, also called Blockchain Won't Save the World. Stay safe out there.